Welcome back to All I Know Is This, a podcast of First Presbyterian Church in Richmond, Virginia. I am Amy Starr Redwine, one of the pastors and the head of staff at the church, and I am delighted to be back for our third season. And in this second episode, I am continuing my conversation with my friend and colleague, Ryan Bonfiglio, who is a professor of Old Testament at Candler School of Theology and is helping us as we unpack our summer sermon series on Micah 6:8. So we dug deep into Micah and verses 1 through 8 in our first episode. So if you haven't listened to that yet, you might want to go back and do that. Today, we're going to start to break down this threefold requirement that Micah lays out for us in verse 8 of chapter 6 to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly is what Micah says God requires of us. And in particular, today we're gonna really focus on the doing justice part of that, and we'll be unpacking that even further in 3 weeks of sermons on justice, where we'll actually look at other texts, two from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament, that also help us to unpack this biblical idea of justice. But I am, again, just, you know, our first conversation just reminded me of why this verse is so powerful. It is a really familiar text, as we talked about. It's one that we can sort of almost hear without hearing because we've heard it so many times. But I think as we unpack these three things, we're going to realize just how much depth it has. So, Ryan, would love to hear what you're thinking about today as we get ready to unpack justice.
Sure. Thanks so much, Amy. It's great to be back with you. I love these conversations that we get to dialogue about these sometimes strange but sacred texts that we base our faith around. So it's really good to do that. And I love this idea, too, of revisiting familiar texts and trying to get a fresh perspective and to look more closely. And I want to start us off by just noting that, you know, these three big commands: do justice, love kindness, walk humbly. That's not the beginning of the verse, right? That's the part of the verse that ends up on our bumper stickers, but there's something that comes right before it. And I briefly just want to frame that for us as we move into these commands. It begins with a question: O mortal, what does the Lord require? And I think this is a really important part of the verse. First, it's who the command is addressed to. O mortal. In Hebrew, that idea of mortal or mortal one, it goes back to this Hebrew word Adam. And we typically think of Adam as the name Adam, right? It's a personal name of the first human. But really in Hebrew, Adam means humanity or human one. It is a reference to being a human person without not being Israelite or non-Israelite, not a woman or a man. It's this generic term for a human one. And I think that's important because this command or this idea of what the Lord requires is not just directed at Christians, not just directed at Jews, not just directed at a particular people, but this is a universal command. It's saying essentially, this is what it means to be human, to do these very things.
I love that, Ryan. And I'm so glad you called our attention to the beginning of the verse, because I think you're exactly right. That we can sometimes forget how it gets set up. And that's going to be interesting when we talk about one of the other passages that we look at that begins in a similar way. Anything that we should know about the word require there, other than that, you know, sort of our own understanding of what that means?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And what I love about this phrase, what does the Lord require, is that it really drills down to the heart of the matter. It's as if God is saying, What is it really all about? What is the big thing that we should be focusing on? And I think what's really interesting, Amy, about this verse is that what it lists is a series of practices, not a series of doctrines or beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a really important point for Christians. We often think about what God requires us of in terms of right ways of thinking or right theology. We use this term orthodoxy, that is right belief. And we think that Christianity is really boiled down to right belief. But Amy, it's really different in Judaism. In Judaism, the focus is on orthopraxy, that is right practice, right? It's not just what do I believe, although that's important too, but how do I live? what do I do? And I think this command of what the Lord requires, the thing to notice is that the things that follow are actions. Do, love, walk. They're concrete ways of being in the world. And I think Christians need to pay attention to it, this, right? We're not saying that what we believe shouldn't matter, but there's something about practice unifying us, even in the midst of diverse views, be they diverse political views, diverse theological views. We can find this unity in how we live and what we practice.
Well, I love that. And particularly when we think about how this verse is addressed to this universal, the Adam, the human, and just reminding us that these practices that the prophet is talking about are not about orthodoxy and the things that we believe. And particularly in this time where we feel so divided by often our especially our political views, the reminder that there are certain things that are really about what it means to be human, not Democrat or Republican or even Christian or non-Christian, but human. And, you know, I mean, as we think about this within the church, and to me, this is just such an important topic in the church right now, like how do we kind of find in our theology what binds us together as humans that we can practice together, you know? And as we probably all know, so many of the ways that the church has ended up splitting or dividing has been over belief, you know, who is allowed to be baptized at what age, who is allowed to come to the communion table. I think the Episcopal Church is talking about that right now, actually, who can be ordained. That's been quite a controversial topic over the years, and even views of who can be married. So, you know, those are all sort of focused on beliefs. And I wonder if by focusing on these practices and, you know, today thinking about justice, could that be something that helps us get away from our differences around those more granular issues and really think about, as a human being created by God, we are called to this practice of justice.
Yeah, I love that idea. And I think there's really a lot of hope in it. You know, in our world today, and the church is not different, much different than our society in this regard, we are so siloed and fragmented in terms of cultural background, religious beliefs, political views, right? And it can seem like there's no way to transgress those boundaries. Like we're just set in our little model. And what our goal is always just to find people who think like us, who we fit with. And I think this focus on practice says, okay, yes, what you believe matters, but there can be these common elements that unite us. This is really true of Jewish synagogues today, where there are, for lack of a better term, different denominations in Judaism. But those denominations are really based on the sort of ways in which people practice Judaism. And so within each synagogue, there can be this huge range of views theologically and politically. But again, the unifying point is practice. And I wonder if that might not be a message of hope for us in the church, that drilling down to these practices, we might find a sense of unity in a world that seems so incredibly disunified.
Well, I agree. That's a really hopeful thought. And I think maybe it's part of what drew me to this text for us as a church this summer. And I think we talked about this in our last conversation, this, because it feels like a sort of back to basics. Like can this allow us to set some of those differences aside and really let our commitment to justice and kindness and humility be the practices that that we can come together around.
Amen.
So I'm wondering if you can help us start to unpack this idea of doing justice that's going to be our focus for the next few weeks. Maybe give us some more background on how justice plays out in the larger Old Testament.
Yeah, I would be happy to do so. You know, where I want to start, Amy, is that when issues of justice come up today, we often rush to the how-to questions. What do I do? What does it look like? What issues should we focus on? And the Old Testament, by and large, cares a lot about the how-to, But even more so, the Old Testament cares about what I would say are the why twos. What are the motivations that lie behind our commitment to justice? And I have to say, Amy, as a parent of an 8-year-old, I think a lot about motivations these days, especially as we enter the summer months. And in a confessional moment, in my worst moments of parents, when at parenthood, when Leo, my son, asks, well, you know, I tell him to do something and he says, why? In my worst moments as a parent, I either say, because I said so, right? I appeal to the authority of a parent, or I say, or else, right? This threat of punishment. And I don't always do it this way, but I can fall back into those areas. And what's really interesting, Amy, is that the Old Testament rarely works that way in terms of motivation. When something is commanded, rarely is the answer because God said so, and God has all of the authority, right? That could work, but that's not how it often goes, or it could be a threat of punishment. And that's not often the case again in the Old Testament. And instead, what we find are these motivations that really try to appeal to our own inner sensibilities about why we should follow a command. And this one passage, Amy, that I love, and I think you're going to be preaching on, Deuteronomy 10, I think really begins to show us some of these internal motivations. And in Deuteronomy 10, it's a passage that actually starts with the same question that Micah starts with. What does the Lord require of you? And then it goes on and talks about following the law and honoring the covenant. And then there's this pivotal moment in verse 17 where we get this word for or because. This is why you are to do it. And what follows that is really amazing. It says, because our God, the God Yahweh that we call by name, is a God who executes justice for the orphan and the widow and who loves the strangers. And the motivation there is really key. It says, we're to be a people who stand for justice because God is a God who stands for justice. We have been made in the image of a God who stands for justice. So again, this is not just stand for justice or else God will punish you, or because it's this important abstract idea. It's that this is knit into our DNA. We are made in the image of this sort of justice affirming God.
I love that. And I think it just speaks so much to our calling to live out of that essentially human part of ourselves. And that maybe goes back to Micah's first question and addressing it to the Adam, is that as human beings created in the image of God, we're called to be imitators of God. And the prophet seems to be talking about that.
I think of this as sort of the vertical motivation for justice. We are made in the image of a God of justice, so that's why we should stand for it. If we keep reading in Deuteronomy 10, there's actually a second motivation, and I call it the horizontal motivation. A little bit further, it says, you are to love the stranger. This is part of the stance for justice. You are to love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And I think there's a lot there, Amy. It's saying that empathy is the key to justice, realizing that at some point, and in some way, there have been moments when we've been on the receiving end of harm, unkindness, unfair treatment, whatever that looks like. It's being able to identify with that experience of others. And it's out of that common sense of love of neighbor and this empathy for what they're going through. That's the horizontal element that, again, we're not just standing for justice because it's this abstract ideal, but we stand for justice because we know what it's like to be on the other end of injustice.
Well, I think that's so important, and particularly that in Deuteronomy, there are these two motivations that are talked about. And I may have shared with you that I have a weekly Bible study and we look at preaching texts ahead of time. So we actually talked about Deuteronomy 10 just last week, and it was a really interesting conversation about these two motivations for justice, and particularly thinking about that sometimes we are going to have to dig deep to remember times when we've maybe been on the other side of things. And for, you know, for the Israelites, that was, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. But, you know, the truth is, for all of us, there are ways that we can empathize and connect with those who are on the, you know, are experiencing injustice and think about how we can help. And I know, and I've had an incredibly privileged life, but there have been moments where I felt like, you know, something happened to me that I was on the side of sort of injustice or at least unfairness. And one of the most difficult things in those times were not so much the people who were direct, who were maybe responsible for that injustice, but sort of the people who knew about it but did nothing. And so I think that that's something, you know, that I think a lot about. And I think that's part of the call here. You know, the other thing I'll say is I consulted Brueggemann on this text and loved how he unpacked this as a call to public theology that sort of, and it made me think about, I think it's Cornel West who says justice is what love looks like in public. And, you know, thinking about justice, and I think often we think about the angry activist when we think about justice, right? But how can we kind of if we think about justice as an act of empathy, to me, that's a little softer and motivated by love and compassion that, you know, literally suffering with others. So, I really appreciate this text and those two parts of it.
And, you know, that's really important point. And I love that Cornel West idea, because we can sometimes think of standing for justice as kind of, as you say, this angry protest. It's just denouncing that which is evil in the world. And there's a role to that. There's an importance to that, to bring to light injustice is an important part of addressing it. But I think in the Old Testament sense, at its core, standing for justice is, again, not that you are standing for a principle, but that you are caring about the people who are harmed. It's really rooted in compassion, a sense that you know that there are people out there who are hurting and being grieved by individual acts of injustice, systemic injustice. And in the Old Testament, there's a way of talking about those people. There's this phrase that we find repeated again and again. It's orphan, widow, and stranger. Mm-hmm. And that triad, or that threefold people, orphan, widow, and stranger, names in kind of a symbolic way the three types of people in the ancient world who would have been marginalized, either for economic or social reasons. They would have been on the outside of society looking in. They would have been vulnerable. They would have been most susceptible to be taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. And so when the Old Testament talks about justice, it's usually not just this generic sense of justice, but it's always justice for a particular group of people, orphan, widow, and stranger. And I think it gets to this idea that you stand for justice because you are aware that there are people out there suffering under injustice, not just because you're for justice in the abstract sense, but you're there for it, for these people. Amy, the other cool thing about this phrase, and this is like the stuff I love to geek out on as someone who teaches Bible, but orphan, widow, and stranger, there are other ancient law codes, like from Hammurabi or from Egypt, that actually talk about justice. So justice is not unique to the Old Testament, but in those law codes that have laws and ideas about justice, it's only ever for the orphan and the widow. The thing you never find in other ancient law codes is the inclusion of the stranger. That is completely unique to the Old Testament. And what I love about that is that in naming the stranger, which, by the way, means someone born outside of Israel, so they're non-Israelite, who come to live in Israel. I think a better translation would be something like refugee or immigrant. But what I love about the Old Testament is it says, yes, we are to care about injustice in the world as they affect the most vulnerable, but it doesn't matter where they're from. It doesn't matter if they were born in Israel, if they're Israelite, if they're Jewish. It's orphan, widow, and stranger. And that uniqueness of the Old Testament, I think there's a lot for us to learn about that.
Well, I love knowing that. So thank you for geeking out with us. That's why we invited you here. And that really is remarkable. And it just, you know, yesterday was Pentecost, and thinking about how, you know, by the power of the Holy Spirit in the book of Acts, we just keep seeing, the Spirit kind of extending or including more and more people. And I think it's such an important reminder to us that this was not something new in, you know, that Jesus brought to Judaism and then what became Christianity, that this is a consistent value of the Israelite faith, the Jewish faith, and that it set that faith apart from the other, you know, sort of ethical, moral, whether they were religions or other codes at the time. I just think that's so important. And I think it's also interesting that, you know, as we named before in terms of right belief, that the church has just continued to struggle with this sort of question of who's mm-hmm. in and who's out. And, you know, that I think just points to what a kind of foundational struggle that is for us. So on the one hand, we are both created and called to be inclusive and to, you know, remember those who are different from us, to not believe that there is a right, you know, race or ethnicity or culture that we would extend justice to, but that it's for all. So there's that piece of it. But then there is also something fundamentally human about wanting to be with our group, you know? So we're both sort of being called into that, but there's a tension there. And it's clear that that tension has been there for a long time. So,
yeah, I think that's right. I would say that our struggle today is an ancient one, and it's not with whether we're good at loving our neighbors. I actually think we are good at loving our neighbors. I think the rub for us is, how do we define who a neighbor is?
Yeah.
Who receives that commitment to love and justice? And I think we tend to define neighbors very narrowly by a very small group of people. But of course, the Old Testament and the New, through the parable of the Good Samaritan, challenges us to expand that vision of what the neighbor is, or who the neighbor is. It's not just a matter of loving neighbor, but it's reimagining neighbor in this more expansive and inclusive way.
Well,
that's the call of justice.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully our listeners are familiar, you know, with the parable of the Good Samaritan. And as that comes to mind, just the reminder that Jesus tells that parable after somebody asks him, well, who is my neighbor? Mm-hmm. After Jesus has talked about love of neighbor. So that whole parable is an answer to that question, and really interesting to think about in that way. How would you say, I mean, as we think about what justice looks like, and we've unpacked that a little bit, and I hope that we can all be thinking about, you know, beyond widows, orphans, and strangers, which, you know, mm-hmm. in some ways still can be marginalized. So I don't want to take away from mm-hmm. that, but in other ways mm-hmm. may not be the most marginalized groups in our current context. How do we think about, you know, Micah doesn't unpack this a lot for us, which is why mm-hmm. we're looking at some of the other texts, but how would you say we have a sense of clarity or confidence that justice is being done?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, because that really is at the heart of the matter for us. And here's where I think we need to make a couple of moves. I think one thing that would be really interesting to do as a faith community is to say, okay, let's imagine you as a faith community are rewriting Micah 6 and 8, or maybe 6, 8, or maybe you're rewriting Deuteronomy 10. Who do you name as the groups? Orphan, widow, stranger, right? Like who would represent the people who are most marginalized and vulnerable, right? And I think mm-hmm. it is different from community to community. I think it is different across time and places. So first is sort of wrapping our minds around, how does this happen locally? What is it like in Richmond? Who do you name as those groups? So mm-hmm. that's the one thing. The second thing we need to do is that we need to begin to imagine what justice looks like. And this is a place, Amy, where the Bible doesn't give us a blueprint, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't give us turn by turn directions. I think the Bible gives us a compass. It sends us off in the right direction, and we know where we're headed. We know where the destination is, but we need to make decisions along the way about mm-hmm. which turns to take. And I think that even just raising the question of what does justice look like is an important step to take. And one thing I think that the Bible teaches us very consistently is that justice, or what is just, is not the same thing as what is legal. What is just is not the same thing as what is legal. Now, there's a lot of overlap. A lot of time, the law does help manifest and enforce principles of justice. That's mm-hmm. definitely the case. But I see them not as completely overlapping circles, but rather like a Venn diagram where there's this section in the middle that is both just and legal. But then there are sections on the outside that don't overlap. And so on the one hand, we have unjust laws, mm-hmm. right? We have laws that I think from our Christian perspective, we would say, yes, that is part of the law, but that does not represent justice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes kind of abiding by that law doesn't line up with our sense of justice. So that's on the one hand. Then on the other hand, there's this sense that justice requires us to go beyond the law. It's a bigger category. Just saying, well, I haven't violated the law, doesn't mean that we have fulfilled our call to justice. And again, I'm thinking back to the Good Samaritan story, which we've already referenced. Remember how the priest and the Levite, they see the man in need who's been robbed and beaten and left for dead on the side of the road, and the priest and the Levite don't go to help him. Mm-hmm. Well, according to ancient law, what they did was not illegal. Mm-hmm. They could not have been arrested or fined. There was no violation of the law in not going to help the man in need. And yet, I think all of us would say, that's a violation of justice, mm-hmm, right? What justice required of them in that moment went beyond what the law required of them. And I think that's the really challenging part for us, Amy, as a Christian faith community. Where does God's call to justice go beyond the call to follow the law, mm-hmm, and to embody the law? What is that space? What does that call us to do? How do we fill that space and venture into that territory? How do we do what the priest and the Levite fail to do in the story of the Good Samaritan?
I think that's such a helpful way for us to think about it. And I love your idea of the Venn diagram where the law and justice do indeed overlap. And I think we are all aware of, you know, that they don't always, that's just a reality. But I also think maybe the other text that we're going to look at when we're thinking about justice can help us in thinking about this too, because, you know, one of the things about the text from Amos chapter 5 is that Amos is just so brutally clear about, you know, that there are certain things that people are doing that are fulfilling their requirements or responsibilities for being God's faithful people according to, you know, the laws and the understanding, theological understanding, like worship and worship practices. You know, he's just so harsh in his criticism of how that's not enough, you know, that when that is not paired with these practices of justice in the ways that we've been talking about it today, that actually is really offensive to God. I mean, mm-hmm, he goes so far as to say, mm-hmm, that. And then it also, you know, I think Jesus gives us so many examples of how the law can be holding us back from justice. And he's, you know, such an incredible reinterpreter of the law and of even setting it aside when it is not allowing us to move, mm-hmm, toward justice. But then the other text that we're going to talk about is actually before Jesus is even born, the Magnificat from Luke chapter 1, which Mary sings. And boy, that is a really clear kind of laying out of what justice might look like. So I think that's something for us to learn from as well.
And that's one of my favorite passages in the New Testament, Amy, this prayer that Mary prays in Luke 1, in part, in fairness, because it echoes an earlier prayer, a prayer by Hannah in the Old Testament in 1 Samuel 2. But both of these women who find themselves, I like to say, unexpectedly expecting Mary because she was a virgin and Hannah because she was barren, they both have this powerful vision of justice where they make this prayer and they imagine a God who brings down the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly, excuse me. They fill the hungry with good things and they send the rich away empty. And these are hard. This is a hard word about justice, right? Because it's a leveling of the playing field. The powerful are brought low. The lowly are brought up. It's kind of like this vision of John the Baptist who prepares the way in the wilderness by saying the mountains will be leveled and the valleys brought up. There's this whole theology that emerges, especially in Luke, of justice being this level playing field.
Yeah.
Where God sees everyone, not according to their money or their might, but rather according to this common humanity. And that's the work of justice, is to create that level playing field. And it does mean that some will be brought up, but it also means, and this makes me uncomfortable, that some will be brought low.
Yeah.
And I'm more comfortable with people being brought up than me being brought low.
Right.
I'll put it that way.
Aren't we all, Ryan? Aren't we all? But I, you know, and I always remind people that in Luke, Jesus' big sermon is the Sermon on the Plain, and rather than the Sermon on the Mount, which it is in Matthew. But again, just speaking to how Luke is really trying to level the playing field. And to me, you know, part of what that suggests is how justice for us, I do believe we are called to justice for, you know, the individual person in front of us, you know, the individual widow or orphan or stranger, mm-hmm. however that plays out in our particular context. But I also think that that leveling that Mary, you know, prays about, and Hannah too, I'm glad you reminded us of that, is about systems, and mm-hmm. that it's, you know, our call to do justice isn't limited to, you know, sort of trying to get justice for individuals, that it can also involve trying to transform the systems that have allowed injustice to not only persist, but to really take root.
Mm-hmm. I think this is the big surprising thing about the prophets. I'm teaching now with Candler students on the prophets, and the thing that they're blown away by is that by and large, the prophets aren't talking about individual generosity or kindness mm-hmm. between individuals. They're actually thinking about how society works, or we would say, they don't use this language, but I think it reflects their emphasis, how systems work. Mm-hmm. They're aware that injustice doesn't just come about because one person is mean. Right. Or, you know, or prejudice or something like that. Injustice sometimes, or maybe oftentimes, comes about because there are systems, ways of being in a culture, in a society, in a political system that actually systematically privilege some and disadvantage others. And the prophets are deeply aware of this. And when they talk about justice, they're very often saying, we need new ways of being as a culture, as a neighborhood, mm-hmm. as a system, right? And to go back, finally, I know we're about to wrap up, but to go back to the Good Samaritan one last time, mm-hmm. there's this great sermon by Martin Luther King on the Good Samaritan. And at the very end, he kind of goes through the classic things about showing generosity and compassion to the neighbor in need. But at the end, Martin Luther King Jr. says, but at some point, we have to start thinking beyond just helping the neighbor in need. At some point, we have to start asking ourselves, why is it that certain people keep getting beaten up and robbed on the road to Jericho, which is where the Good Samaritan story is set. At some point, Martin Luther King says, we have to actually reconstruct the road itself so as to prevent these systems of abuse from happening. And I think in offering, I love that commentary, in thinking of it, Martin Luther King Jr. recognizes that it is a both and. Yes, mm-hmm. of course, we need to help the individual neighbor in need. And we also need to do what I call the road work, yeah. the reconstructing the road to Jericho, so that this doesn't keep happening again and again and again. And I think mm-hmm. what MLK is channeling here is really the spirit of the prophets, who are both paying attention to what does justice look like at an individual level? But then what does justice look like at a societal or neighborhood level?
Mm-hmm. That just gave me chills. I don't think I've ever heard that interpretation, but I think it's brilliant and so important, because there is, you know, we've talked a lot today about these tensions that are inherent in doing justice. And I think that's a great one for us to kind of end on, is that tension between our call as individuals to help individuals that we recognize are suffering from injustice in some way, but that we also then need to tend to the systems that mm-hmm. have contributed to, you know, those injustices. So it really is this balance, this practice, as we talked about. And, you know, what I also really appreciate about Micah's call, this threefold call, is that I think they really balance each other out. And we'll maybe talk more about that as we get into the next two. But, you know, within them, trying to seek a balance in our practice, mm-hmm. which is going to be lifelong. This has been, you know, as we've recognized today, so many of the same challenges that these texts were born out of still exist in, you know, different ways and forms, but certainly still exist today. So there's still work to be done. There's still justice to be sought. So Ryan, I can't thank you enough. This has been, again, such a great conversation, and really look forward to continuing to unpack this rich verse and to getting to talk with you more. So thank you so much.
Awesome. It was great having the conversation, Amy. Thank you.
All right. Join us for this ongoing sermon series in worship or online. You can find out all sorts of information at fpcrichmond.org. We would love to connect with you. Thanks for listening.